You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
Los Angeles is a wonderful place to live. It might even be a better place to write about. These are the words of best-selling author Michael Connelly, a former Los Angeles resident whose work as a journalist for the Los Angeles Times' Crime Beat has influenced his prolific body of work, and where, on his first day on the job, an editor told him, "LA is a sunny place for shady people." And so, Los Angeles has become the context for Connelly's novels, a place where the sun and shade bleed with intrigue and suspense. The Gods of Guilt is the sixth novel in the Lincoln Lawyer series, where we ride through the city with protagonist Mickey Haller, a character whose original inspiration came from a conversation Connelly had at Dodger Stadium with a lawyer back in 2001. During that game, Connelly learned that this particular lawyer's office was in his Lincoln town car. And hence, Connelly decided to dub this successful series the Lincoln Lawyer series. Six novels in, the tense, adrenaline-ridden thrill of courtroom drama continues with The Gods of Guilt, begging us to look beyond Haller and into the deeper, darker regions of our own conscious, where our internal gods of guilt reign. Michael Connelly is a master plotter with compelling protagonists who writes with the skill of a Pulitzer Prize-nominated journalist and unrivaled researcher. His body of work includes 25 novels and one work of nonfiction. Six of his novels have held the number one position on the New York Times' bestseller list, and two of them have been adapted to film: Bloodwork, which was produced and directed by Clint Eastwood, and Lincoln Lawyer, which starred Matthew McConaughey. 50 million copies of Connelly's books have sold worldwide and have been translated into 39 languages. His talents also extend beyond the literary realm, where he's working on a TV series to premiere in spring 2014, titled after his other main character, Detective Harry Bosch. He's also co-producing a documentary about the Minneapolis-born jazz musician, saxophonist Frank Morgan, called Sounds of Redemption. We are thrilled to welcome Connelly back to the place he once called home and to the place where his characters reside. Speaking with Connelly tonight is another former Crime Beat journalist for the LA Times, Angelino and author Miles Corwin, who spent the first years of his life living down the street from the LA Public Library at the then family-owned Rosslyn Hotel, is the author of three nonfiction books, including national bestseller The Killing Season and Still We Rise, and Homicide Special, a Los Angeles Times bestseller. His novels include Kind of Blue and Midnight Alley, the latter of which is available for sale tonight in the lobby. Corwin also teaches in the Literary Journalism Department at UCI. Please help me in
thanks, everybody, for coming.
As Our introducer mentioned, I used to work as a crime reporter for the LA Times, like Michael, and I wrote a couple of nonfiction books about homicide detectives. So I spent a lot of time with homicide detectives, and oftentimes, when I first meet a homicide detective, oftentimes one of the first questions they ask me is, I really like that guy. I mean, they ask me, do you know Michael Connelly? And I said, yeah. And then they say, I really like that guy. And I say, yeah, Connelly, he's really a down-to-earth, really great person, helps other writers. They go, not him. I like Harry Bosch. And they really connect to him. And I think that's one of the reasons that Michael Connelly's so successful is that he really gets the details right, he does his research, and if you can appeal to a discriminating, curmudgeonly group like homicide detectives and win them over, you know you're doing the right thing. So you were a police reporter. Your main characters in your early books were Harry Bosch, who was a detective, and Jack McAvoy, who was a reporter. And then you segued to a whole new arena, which is the legal arena. What made you decide to transition to an area that you didn't have the background in and create a lawyer protagonist?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, one is, you know, the criminal defense attorney is part of, I guess, the larger arena. You know, and it certainly would have been in the world, is in the world that Harry Bosch and that McAvoy transit in. So it would be part of a desire to kind of, you know, cover the waterfront, cover everything from all angles. But I think also it goes into way back into the roots of me wanting to become a writer, part of that process, and it was a long process. I got, you know, I was reading books that led me to the epiphany that I want to try to do this, but I was reading a lot of books before I really knew that. And one of them was To Kill a Mockingbird, which we actually read in a library. I grew up in South Florida, and I spent a lot of the summers in the library because it was, mostly because it was air-conditioned, not because I was reading. And a librarian who saw me without a book, you know, took me to the stacks, and there was multiple copies of Kill a Mockingbird. This was in the late 60s. And you know, said, if you're going to come in here every day, read this book and, you know, turn over a page and mark it and then hide it somewhere because we got plenty of them here and this will be your book and you keep reading it till it's done. And so I had that experience and, you know, it's still kind of like a teacher giving you an assignment. So I've always kind of got my back up against reading for assignment. But at the same time, I liked the book. Probably didn't know the value of that book as a great American novel. But I liked, obviously, Atticus and his courtroom and his, him being a lawyer or being a man who would risk or put things closest to him at risk in order to do the right thing. And so I think that kind of started me on a path that I've always loved legal fiction, legal stories, nonfiction and fiction. And so I think I was always on the lookout for a way of doing it. It was intimidating because most of the great practitioners of the legal thriller today are actually lawyers, and I was a degree short in that. And so I had to be careful and be ready to do it, and so it wasn't something I jumped in right away when I started writing fiction. It was years down the road, and then I had that moment of serendipity when I met a guy who operates like Mickey Haller, and it became an obvious framework for me to take my stab at legal thriller.
With your writing about homicide detectives and writing about reporters, you obviously had a lot of sources. You knew who to go to. How did you, and research is such an important part of what you do, getting the details right. How did you transition? Were there besides this one person? Were there other group of people you could go to get it right?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, as far as getting it right. Actually, these books, like Gods of Guilt, take much more time and research away from the actual writing than, like, say, a Harry Bosch book. The guy I met at the Dodger Stadium, I stayed in contact with him. He's retired now and lives up in Montana. But he wasn't the guy. I took his idea. And then I knew some other defense attorneys much better, including my college roommate was a defense attorney. And so I went to him and said, can I be a fly on the wall in your life? And it wasn't just about being how you work cases, but it's also how cases work you and how you live with what you've chosen to do as a career and so forth. I wanted personal and business, you know. So when I say a fly on the wall, I meant every wall. And he agreed, but he had a partner, and he said, you know, my partner and I share everything, so I would like to bring my partner into it. So I now had two lawyers. And those two were extremely helpful, and they've been helpful in every book, and many of the exploits and shortcuts, and so if you want to, that's a nice way of saying some of the stuff Mickey does is just a shortcut. Many of them came from those guys, and then there was a judge who recently retired, Judge Champagne, Judy Champagne. She was very helpful in the early stages of formulating the character and some of the choreography of courtrooms and so forth. She gave me a lot of access to her courtroom.
I know with your Bosch books, there's two homicide detectives who you know, who I know as well, and they're kind of your go-to guys to check to make sure things are done right. Are there some lawyers besides the ones who got you started who are your kind of go-to people who you'll to verify things are done right and things are
well? The good thing about doing these is that lawyers always contact me to tell me how I got stuff wrong. So I think those two guys are my main go-to guys, and like they vet different my first drafts. I often go to them and say, "This is what I need to have happen." And I want it to be realistic, you know. So what are the legal maneuvers that would make this happen? And they'll go off and come back with, sometimes they're, even though they're partners, they'll have different ways of doing it. And I pick the one that will work dramatically best for me. And then there's some lawyers that help me along the way in a much smaller capacity, but it's basically those two.
To shift now away from the legal books, Harry Bosch is in his early 60s. Is he 63? Have you calculated exactly how old he is?
Well, I've only said that he was born in 1950, so I like to think he was born on New Year's Eve, so he's not 63 yet.
Oh, 63, okay.
But in a few weeks, I'm trying to keep him as young as possible, so I've picked New Year's Eve.
Okay, so as you know, that's pretty old for a homicide detective. Any plans for him to retire, and if so, any plans for what he would be doing after that in your books?
Well, there's two answers. One is about books, and one's about the realism or reality of what he's doing. And it's said in the books that he's on this, you know, the drop, the deferred retirement option plan, and he'll be retiring in 2015. So that's out there. You know, when I started writing about Harry 20-some years ago, I gave him an age, and 1950 is a year of birth. And when I got a chance to write another book, I decided I would age him. And, you know, I never could see that I'd be 20 years later still writing about him. But, you know, that's very lucky. And, you know, so it does mean that there's a kind of like a shelf life to him having a badge. You know, you kind of live by that idea, you die by it. So that's what's going to happen. I don't regret it because I like the idea of, like, by the time it'll be done, it'll be almost 25 years of a guy evolving against the city evolving. And you can't ask for, from a writer standpoint or an anthropologist standpoint, you can't ask for a better run or task or project to be handed. So it's been great. And there'll be something freeing about when he retires, because then I can break away from this chronological, like he ages in real time, the stories are in the year they're published. I feel I can break from that. I can go back in time. I can fill in some stuff. I love to write about Harry Bosch in Vietnam. I've been gathering string, to use a journalism phrase, on 1972, where I've said in the books was his rookie year, and it was a really interesting year in Los Angeles. And I'm going to be able to, I want to write about Harry becoming a cop. So there's back stuff to do, and then who knows what will happen in the future. There's a lot of seeds been planted in the books, mainly involving his daughter. And so I see him around, you know, as long as I can be able to write in larger and sometimes smaller capacities.
I mean, he was a cop, and then he left and he became a private detective, and then he went back to being a cop. Chance that he can go back to the PI work in future books? I know you're going to look back. Are you going to?
He could do that, but one reason why I brought him back to the police department was when the year he was a private eye, basically wrote one book when he was a private eye, I realized I didn't like doing that with him. And so I'm my mind's churning to try to not follow that path. Maybe that will be what happened, but I hope I can. I like the idea of him being not like a guy for hire, but just somebody who still carries, he's got man on a mission, and he'll see something that's not right that falls under that category of everybody counts or nobody counts, and he'll do something about it. And the other aspect is him as a mentor. I'm writing a book now for next year, a Harry Bosch book, and he has a new partner, and he's been specifically assigned to this young detective because they know he's on his way out, and they know he carries a lot of experience and knowledge, and they want to try to get some of that into this person that will hopefully be a detective for the next 25 years in the department. So it's been an interesting, you know, I'm only about 100 pages into the book, but it's been an interesting, a different take on Harry.
I know a detective named Rick Jackson, you use used him a lot for research, and that is it. I've heard something about the fact that when Harry left the police department and he was retired, you didn't think he could come back.
Right.
And then you talked to Rick and realized that he had left the police department and he actually did come back. And it, yeah. Was that the impetus for Harry coming back to the LAPD?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I want to have a real realism in the books, and I had always heard or felt that, you know, like you leave the LAPD, you don't get to come back, so you better make a very careful decision whether or not to leave. And what happened was Rick did leave the department, moved all the way to Maine and start another life, and realized it was a mistake, that he's a man on a mission and needs to come back. And he was allowed to come back. And when I realized that and talked to him about it, I realized I had a path back for Harry that was realistic. And so that's what I did. And, you know, Harry on the drop, Rick Jackson did the same thing. So I have, just like with the lawyer books, I have some cops, as you mentioned, who detectives who are really great about helping me get it right, you know, and invaluable. And in many ways, I really kind of take very specifically from their own lives.
Rick Jackson was a character in the book I wrote, Homicide Special. I interviewed him extensively, and he had told me that he left the LAPD to go back, and then he decided after a couple years, he wanted to go back to become a detective again. He left, he was working other jobs in Maine, he decided he wanted to come back to LA. And he said the LAPD interviewers asked him a number of questions. Some of them were a little bit bizarre. And Rick is quite a jokester, and so one of the questions they asked him in the series of 80 questions for his to be back in the police department was, they asked him, have you ever had sex with animals? And Rick's response was, now are you talking about before I was at the LAPD or the time that I've come back? And so,
and yet they let him back in.
And they let him back in. So, in fact, I asked Rick Jackson if he had a specific question for Michael, and he did. And he said, I know police detectives. Rick Jackson was a homicide detective for many decades, and he just retired. And he said, I know police detectives love the Harry Bosch character. How do defense attorneys react to Mickey Haller?
That's good. That's, I was expecting some kind of
that's not the only
cheap
question.
Shot. Okay. No, I think no matter who you write about, people who do that for a living respond to sincerity. Like, I sincerely want to get the life of a homicide detective right. And I'm not just talking about, you know, the procedure and the forensics and all that. I'm talking about what it's like to do that job and what it does to you. And it's the same with, you know, defense attorneys. And I think, you know, Mickey is kind of a... you know, a snappish type of guy, because he doesn't think it's a fair fight. He wants a fair fight, and he looks at all the power and might that the state has and doesn't feel that's fair. And I think when I get that kind of flavor into the book, defense attorneys respond to it, because I think that's almost a universal feel. It's been great that people... I've gotten a lot of tips from lawyers who... Look, will come to me in a book signing. And there's a moment in here where Mickey Haller, a criminal, goes to yank him by the tie, and his tie comes off because it's a clip-on. And that was a defense attorney who came through a book signing line and said to me, here's a tip. I always wear a clip-on tie for when they reach through the bars to grab me.
Yeah, that's a great detail.
And it's like, that is a little moment that says a lot about that life, and that's what I'm, you know, that's what I'm seeking. And you know, I don't even know the name of the guy who told me that. He just was in and out, you know. So it was, it's fun.
Like all good homicide detectives, Rick has a follow-up question. So, which is, he says, both Bosch and Haller have missions, very divergent missions, and are willing to bend the rules to accomplish their respective missions. Yet Bosch gets described as heroic, while Haller often gets the sleazy label, but both are fighting for what they believe in. Care to discuss your thoughts on this?
He really said that?
Yep.
No, I think that's right. I mean, that's from the standpoint of being the writer, that's one of the great challenges I love to try to meet. When I write about a Harry Bosch book, I know on page one, I kind of have all the readers in my pocket. They're with me, because who doesn't want this guy to accomplish his mission? He's trying to take some pretty evil people off the tart, you know, take them out of the game. And who doesn't want that to have happen? And then when I go to a Mickey Haller story, I have quite a challenge in that I need to get the reader to want to jump in that Lincoln and ride with him through the story. And it's not an easy thing to do. And most often are not in the books. I start off with him doing something that is, if not underhanded, is at least a shortcut. And so I always start off from the standpoint of like less than zero, you know, and I have to build up and, hopefully it works. You do that a lot by the internal discussions and thoughts that Mickey has, and hopefully little by little the reader realizes that ultimately this guy's a fair guy, that he wants a fair outcome, that he wants to do the right thing in whatever situation he's in.
One thing I was just curious about, you had once, when I talked to you, said that you write every day. Is that 7 days a week? You try to write every day?
Well, what I do is when I start a draft of a book, I attempt to write every day until I'm done that draft, and then I'll take days off, and then I'll go to draft two and attempt to write every day. I can't say, for 25 years, I've never missed a day, But, I had a teacher, a writer named Harry Cruz, was a teacher I had in college, and he said, you got to write every day, but he added, even if it's only for 15 minutes. And that was just because it keeps the story churning in your imagination, even if you can only get 15 minutes in. And so I've had many of those days where it's just 15 minutes. I'll be writing on a laptop as I go to bed, and that's all I've done that day, and I get tired, and after 15 minutes I'm out. But it's a goal more than something I think I accomplish.
On a rough estimate, how long will it take you to write a draft?
A draft?
Yeah, where you will write every day a little.
It depends on what it is. A Bosch draft I'll go much faster. Lincoln lawyer draft will be longer, largely because as I'm writing it, I'm probably shooting messages to the lawyers saying, like, I need this to happen. How do I have it? How does it work? And it's not like they give me answers right away. Whereas if I call up one of the cops and say, what do you call this procedure? Or what is the procedure? I get answers more, pretty quickly. And I think that adds to the speed. It's hard for me to say how long drafts are. All I know is it takes me in total about 10 months to write a book.
And would the draft be maybe roughly 6 months for one of Lincoln lawyer books?
Yeah, probably around there.
And maybe
5 or 6 months.
Less for a Harry Bosch book?
Yes.
Here's something that I was just always curious about, because Steve Harvey, our former colleague at the LA Times, told me that your first book, The Black Echo, which is still one of my favorites, that a critic had lambasted you for the fact that the plot wasn't accurate, or it would seem kind of unrealistic, and you, of course, have a background on that.
Washington Post.
Tell us about that?
It's rare that you get your first book reviewed almost anywhere, but the Washington Post reviewed it, and the summary of it was, it's a pretty good book, but it revolves around a heist. The central heist that the case revolves around is unbelievable, and that was, even though the book's fiction, that was the only thing that was real in the book. It was based on a real heist here in downtown L.A.
Could you tell them about the heist? Because it's a really interesting heist.
Well, it was, I think it was the Bank of America building that over, I think it was July 4th weekend in 1987, because it was associated with when I moved here, and I don't exactly remember the dates, but it would have been 87. Anyway, over a three-day weekend, thieves used the massive tunnel system we have, stormwater drainage system that we have here in Los Angeles, and they drove in, I think, about 3 miles from an entrance over on 3rd Street, and they went all the way down into downtown and got underneath, and then they built their own tunnel, a short tunnel underneath a Bank of America vault, and then they went up and broke into the vault and spent all weekend opening safe deposit boxes and, you know, prying them open and taking all the contents and then leaving. And it was never solved. It's still never been solved. And I was just starting as a reporter of the LA Times, and I got to sit in on a briefing where the detectives were going around to all the outlying police stations to tell them about it and what signs to look for, because it was so professionally done, we know they'll do it again. And so I got all these details, and I thought this would be a great portion of a plot for a book I was trying to write. So in exacting detail, the heist is in that book, and the reviewer at the Washington Post didn't buy it.
that's classic. And when you came out to LA, were you thinking, I don't have a plot in mind, but I know I want to write a crime novel when I come here, I'm going to come upon something as a crime reporter? And was that sort of what happened on that first book?
Well, it's the same kind of serendipity that would later have the Lincoln lawyer sit next to me at a baseball game. It just kind of fell into my lap. I grew up in South Florida. I tried writing books set in South Florida twice. I wrote two books that no one's ever seen, no one's ever read other than me, and they weren't worthy of being read. And so, I was thinking like the three strikes and you're out. I'd get one more chance to do this, because it was, you know, I was writing as a full-time reporter and doing this at night and on weekends, and I was married and so forth. So it was a lot to ask to keep trying and trying and trying. So thought it would be good creatively to shake things up. So got a job at the LA Times and moved 3,000 miles. And I just came out here knowing, I hope the muse is here, that I put it together this time. And this heist happened on the weekend I moved here. And you know, it was a front page story. It wasn't my story. It was another reporter's story. But then I was assigned certain police stations, and I happened to be in one when they gave this briefing, and that's where so it was like one of these things that kind of fell into my lap. And, you know, it wasn't like I didn't have anything going on at that idea. I had growing ideas of writing about a detective who was from Vietnam. And as a kid, I knew someone who had been a tunnel rat. And I was very intrigued by that, very scared by that. And so this was a tunnel heist, and I just immediately, like Adam smashing together, I realized I would write about a former tunnel rat who was a detective, and this was his case, and it will all mix together, and it all kind of came together all almost in a moment.
If hadn't sold, if you would have been afflicted with the three strikes, would have you continued doing it?
I don't know. It's as you know, it's a tough journey. It's climbing a mountain, and there's an ego component to this. You write these stories because you think they should be read or heard or seen or turned into movies. I mean, that's one of the reasons behind the motivation. And so, if it's not working out, do you keep doing that? How many books do you try to write before you say, I think I'll just be a reporter? I mean, I had a really cool and interesting job. I mean, it was covering crime for the LAPD in the 90s. You just can't beat that in the late 80s. So I think I would have found a way psychologically to be satisfied with just doing my job as a very interesting job as a newspaper reporter.
Getting to your latest book, The Gods of Guilt, in the acknowledgments, you wrote that the starting point for the story came alive during a discussion with the two producers of the movie, The Lincoln Lawyer. Can you tell us how that kernel began?
This book came out of two things. One is that they made a movie a few years ago on the first book, The Lincoln Lawyer, that was a very well-done movie, in my opinion, and was successful in their opinion. And so they wanted to try to make a sequel, But the three books that followed that I wrote, they didn't like. And so they sat me down and said, the reason we don't like them is that in The Lincoln Lawyer, what motivates Mickey Haller is that he knows in his gut that there's someone in prison for life because of a mistake he made. An innocent man is in prison. His client is in prison. And that guilt is what motivates him through that book. And your three subsequent books are great stories about how a lawyer takes care of a case and all this stuff, but it doesn't have that personal component of motivation. And so that was the starting point. So because I'm in favor of having Matthew McConaughey play this guy again. So I was thinking, all right, that might, you know, these guys aren't dummies, and maybe there is something to that. So I endeavored to come up with a story that would have a sense of a personal connection or guilt at the center of it for Mickey. And that's where the other part of the component is that I don't acknowledge in there. But just one day I was watching CNN, and they had a story on a drunk driving accident in, I think it was either Alabama or Mississippi, where a guy, a drunken driver, plowed into a family and killed them. And the local newspaper examined this guy's record, and it turned out he had six or seven DUI convictions. And at some point, you get prison time. And on that conviction, where he would have gotten prison time, his attorney challenged it, saying that the breathalyzer was not calibrated properly, and the guy got off. And so I watched that thing, and I said, boy, I'd hate to be the lawyer who did that. And it was good lawyering. It was what he was supposed to do, but he has to live with what happened, you know, 6 months later. And so I kind of snatched that idea and gave it to Mickey. And it's not a big part in the story. It's covered very quickly in the beginning, but basically that's what he did. He got a guy off on a technicality, on a DUI, and then he later killed two people. And he has to deal with that. Like, A, on one side, I did my job. I did what I went to law school for. I did what the Constitution says I should do. But why don't I feel proud about it? Why does my daughter, has she stopped talking to me? And so that's the guilt that I think motivates him. And the story's about how Mickey can attempt or tries to redeem himself in for himself and for his daughter and for his ex-wife, the people that he is closest to, and how he tries to alleviate that guilt. And for him, I don't know whether this is misguided, but he thinks that he has an innocent client, and he thinks by winning that day, by winning that case, it makes up for a lot of this. I mean, it's in shorthand, when I try to explain it, it's hard to explain, but I think that's what the book's about. It's about Mickey trying to redeem himself for something that went horribly wrong, even though he did the right things.
You explain in the book the title. Maybe you could just read the page or so where the title is explained.
Well, this is the... I always say I like to have titles that are... that mean different things at different times. And what I was just explaining about the motivation, obviously, the guilt that is motivating Mickey in this is, you know, he has this idea that everybody has a jury inside, the gods of guilt, that, you know, judge each of us. The main reason for it is the real jury, and this is where it comes forward. I'm just going to read about a page and a half here. This is Mickey giving an opening statement in a murder case involving a client named Lacoste. The first juror I locked eyes with was number four. She was Mallory Gladwell, age 28, and a script reader for a movie studio. Her job was to analyze scripts submitted to the studio for purchase and development. As soon as she was seated and questioned during voir dire, I knew I wanted her on the jury. I wanted her analytical skills when it came to storytelling and logic. I wanted the jury to ultimately choose my story over Forsythe's, the prosecutor. And my gut feeling was that Mallory Gladwell could be the one who led them there. Throughout Forsythe's presentation of the state's case, I kept my eyes on Mallory. It was true that I watched all the jurors, trying to read faces and pick up tells and cues as to what testimony or evidence had the strongest impact on them, what they were skeptical about, what got them angry, and so on. But I had Mallory down as the alpha. My guess was that her skills at breaking down the story would lead her to be a voice, if not the voice, during deliberations. She could be my Pied Piper, and therefore she was the one I made the first eye contact with, and she would be the last. I wanted her invested in the defense's case. The fact that she returned the eye contact and did not look away was a strong signal to me that my instincts were on target. "Ladies and gentlemen," I began, "I don't think any introduction is needed here. We are all well into this trial, and I'm pretty sure we know who everybody is. So I'm going to be pretty brief here because I just want to get to the case, to the truth about what happened to Gloria Dayton." As I spoke, I unconsciously moved two steps forward, spread my hands, and put them down on the front rail of the jury box. I leaned forward, trying to make the communication between one man and 12 strangers as intimate as a one-on-one with a priest or a rabbi. I wanted each one of them to think I was talking only to them. "You know, lawyers have all sorts of nicknames for things, including juries. We call you people the gods of guilt. Not in any sort of disrespect for religion or faith, but because that's what you are, gods of guilt. You sit here and you decide who is guilty and who is not, who goes free and who does not. It is a lofty and yet weighty burden. To make such a difficult decision, you must have all the facts. You must have the whole and true story. You must have the proper interpretation of the story." I glanced again directly at Mallory Gladwell. I lifted my hands off the rail and moved back into the well so I could cover the entire 12 and the two alternates in a tight back-and-forth sweep. As I spoke, I casually moved to my right so that most of the jurors were looking at me on their left. "I ask that over the next few days or week, you pay close attention to the defense's case. You have heard only one side of the story so far, the prosecution's side. But now you're going to hear and see another side. You're going to see that there are two victims in this case. Gloria Dayton, of course, is a victim, but so too is Andre Lacasse. Like Gloria, he was manipulated and used. She was murdered, and Andre has been set up to take the fall for it. Realistically, my job here is to sow the seeds of doubt in your mind. If you have reasonable doubt when it comes to Andre's guilt or innocence, then it is your job to find the defendant not guilty. But over the next few days, I will go beyond that, and you will come with me. You will come to know that Andre is completely innocent, and you will come to know who really committed this terrible crime." I paused here, but kept my eyes moving across the faces of the jurors. I had them. I could tell. So that move he makes where he says, I casually moved to my right so that most of the jurors were looking at me on their left. There's a whole thing in here about how, of left brain, right brain thing, and how Mickey believes that if people are looking at you from the left, they're more likely to agree with you than if they're looking at you from the other direction. And there is actually some psychological testing and data that supports that. So it's one of his tricks, shortcuts, whatever you want to call it, but he always gets the spot so that people are looking at him from the left.
Did you get that from a lawyer, or was that something that you decided to come up with?
No, it was just something I read somewhere. But I think a lot of lawyers will pick it up after this. That's why I took the seat, by the way.
I don't want to give away the beginning, but you have a very dramatic scene in the beginning that would some court watchers might call cagey, some sleazy. Is that based on something that you had heard from a lawyer, or based on something that happened in a courtroom?
It was based on a story I heard, but then I took it to an exaggerated level. And Mickey actually does something that he would probably certainly be disbarred for if revealed, but he's taken enough precautions where the only person who could make this accusation is a criminal, so he felt pretty comfortable doing it.
The challenge of writing a series and is to have the character evolve and grow. And I mean, and you, with Harry Bosch, he starts out at Hollywood Homicide, and then he's a private detective. He's at RHD. He's at the Cold Case. You know, and you see kind of an arc of a career. Is it difficult with a lawyer? I mean, who is it kind of static? And do you how do you accomplish that that evolution in a series with a lawyer that you've done?
Well, I think that's a really good question because I've been troubled by that. I love this character and I want to keep writing about him, but in a way there's only so many permutations and everything goes to the same room, a courtroom. And although that can be extremely tense, there's usually only one or two outcomes that can come out of that. And so that makes the longevity of the Lincoln Lawyer series, I think, in question. I have kind of sat back and realized I've written five Lincoln Lawyer books. They all have trials, and there's only been one verdict. So things happen, because I don't want to write a bunch of books that always end with a verdict. I think what you can, if people have been riding along and know these books, you can see that in Decision in Me, the last book ended on a very up note with Mickey being a leading candidate to be the DA, and I was thinking that would be a way to keep the series going. He flips and goes on the other side, and then he's on the side of the right and might, and in buddies with Harry Bosch, and they prosecute a bunch of murders, and then in the off time, I wrote a couple other books since that one. I realized, that's not right. That's not right for that character. He wouldn't jump ship or jump to the other side. And so this book had to have a carefully constructed reason or plot for why he didn't win that election.
You've got the TV series coming out in the spring on Amazon. And what's the title of it?
Bosch.
And it's not based on any one book. Is it a kind of a... an original plot, or are things drawn from different books?
It's got everything. I mean, the first season is based on a book called City of Bones, and then we take either in big ways or very small ways from a bunch of different books, including Concrete Blonde and Lost Light. I'm writing a Harry Bosch book for next year that had a location that I came upon in my research that I really liked, so I actually put that into the script as well. All we have shot is a pilot, and the idea is that the City of Bones case will be spread over 12 episodes, so it's just the beginning of that story. I can tell people I saw the production, the first cut of it today, and I just thought it was great. Very happy with it.
And who's playing Harry Bosch?
A character actor named Titus Welliver. Not a household name. His face is probably recognizable to a lot of people. He's in a lot of shows. He's a very good actor. And what got him the job in the room, as they say, he came in to audition, and as soon as he left, we said that we just sat with Harry Bosch, was the intensity and relentlessness that he can project without saying a word. Harry doesn't say a lot of words in the book, and he's not going to say a lot of words in the show. But he's got to really show what's inside. I'm lucky in writing the books. I can tell you what's going on inside him, but in a TV script or a movie script, you cannot say that. It's up to the actor to present it, and he was he certainly can do it. And I the proof is in the pudding. Doesn't matter what we saw in the audition. It's what we got when we filmed, and I just saw it all cut together today, and I'm really happy.
Is it time for questions? Did you say?
7 minutes or so.
Okay. In all the Bosch books...
You want to call Rick Jackson?
Yeah.
To help you?
Yeah. So, I should have... You only had two questions, though. Music is a big part of the Bosch books, but in The Lincoln Lawyer, it doesn't really play a big part in it. Is that kind of... Just didn't seem to fit in with the character? Or?
It might have come out of... the intensity, not intensity, but how much research is needed and how much I'm on the phone and so forth. I don't really play music when I'm writing Lincoln Lawyer books. I've had a few of the books where music is more in there. I don't know if there's any music in this book at all. But for some reason, I really associate Harry Bosch and music, especially obviously jazz, which is what he listens to. And It can be a way of shading character or deliberating character. I think someone who listens to jazz, which is a very, to me, it's like a solitary music. It's a, more obscure music. These are all things that I think spoke to the character I was trying to develop in Harry Bosch, so I chose jazz. It wasn't the music that I loved growing up, and so it was a learning process for me, and I think in the latter Bosch books, the music that he chooses to listen to is more interesting or less obvious than the first references in the books. The musical choices have evolved over time. You know, I get this idea. It's a weird thing. Music is important in these books, and yet the reader can't hear the music. So it's like, how does that work? And I'm not really sure how it works, but I think it does work. And it also comes out of the writing process. It's helpful to me. There's a song by Frank Morgan. I know we mentioned a documentary I'm involved with on him. Called Lullaby, that when I heard it, it just struck me as being almost synonymous with Harry Bosch. It's a song I play quite often at the beginning of a writing day, to kind of drop me into the Harry Bosch mode. And so I think it's important in the writing process, and if it comes out and adds at all to the reading process, then that's, you know, the old win-win situation. But I think it's more for me than for the reader. But I think that will change some when, like with this show, there's a scene where the first time we see Harry in his house. There's 17 Harry Bosch books, and the only location that's in all the books is his house. You know, there's different police stations and detective bureaus. Things change through the books. The one thing that's never changed is his house and the back deck where he contemplates the city. And so when we were constructing this TV show, we were talking about what is important, and that was the number one thing on the list. Harry by himself, contemplating the city. And so we have this scene, which I think is the heart of the pilot, where the camera just kind of moves slowly across. It's night. It's moving slowly across Harry's house and his things. You see the turntable, and Lullaby is playing, and then eventually the camera goes out through the door, and there's Harry on the deck looking out at the city, and that's all there is. I mean, it has nothing to do with plot, but it has everything to do with character. And you know, when I was watching that today, it's like, wow, this is the book come to life.
When you're writing Bosch books, do you always listen to music while you're writing?
Not all the time. I mean, I certainly will listen to the music I'm mentioning, but it's not like I have a routine where music's always playing.
But you said it gets you into the zone. Do you always start writing with music?
Not always. I don't want to ever say I always, like, I don't claim to write every day, even though I should. You know, there's days I don't. I don't start every day listening to Lullaby. There were times in my writing career where it was very much more important than it feels now to me, and I would be raising the flag every day by playing that song, you know. So it's much more important in Bosch than the other books, but you know, I wrote a book a long time ago, 10 or 12 years ago, called Void Moon, and it takes place in I think it takes place in 2 days. And it's a lot of the live. It takes place in a car, and the woman who Cassie Black, who's the protagonist of that story, just has one CD, and she plays. It's a Lucinda Williams, "Car Wheels on a Gravel Road," which is a great record. And so she listens to it, and I quote from it, and all that stuff. And on the book and in reading it, and you read it in 3 or 4 days, it all sounds great. But I listened to that record over and over again during the whole process of writing that book. I always had it on, and it killed me. Now I can't stand that record.
I remember Frank Morgan. The first time I heard of Frank Morgan was when I read the obit in the LA Times, and it was such a fascinating obit. He just had such an incredible life. And you're doing a documentary on him now?
Yeah, I was lucky. I sort of knew Frank. We did a couple things together. He did the music for kind of a promotional documentary where my words from my books were set to film, and we used Frank Morgan's music. He played here all the time.
Can you just give a little capsule version of who Frank Morgan is?
He was a saxophone player who was a child prodigy, and he by the time he was 14, he was playing like in Club Alabama, playing in places on Central Avenue. He caught the eye of Charlie Parker, and Charlie Parker mentored him and saw something in him, you know, of all the people that were playing saxophone and in that great scene, he zeroed in on Frank Morgan as being the heir apparent. And unfortunately, Charlie gave him more than musical mentoring, and he got hooked on heroin, and which led him down a path of crime. He's actually, in his words, a pretty good criminal. In a weird way, he was proud of how many millions of dollars he stole over time, but it was all in support of drugs, and it was not just him. It would be a whole cadre of jazz musicians who committed crimes to support habits and so forth, and they all ended up in prison, and they all ended, not all of them, but many of them ended up in San Quentin, where they had a jazz band called the San Quentin All-Stars, and it was like a who's who of great jazz musicians. Art Pepper was there, and many, many people traveled through, and Frank ended up spending 28 years in prison, and always playing in the band, and so he really kind of perfected the art. And when he came out, and when he finally swore off drugs and that life, at in the last third of his life, he recorded about 15 records that were really good and inspired me and inspired Harry Bosch and other people as well. And it's such an interesting story of highs and lows and ultimate redemption that, to me, it begged to be told in whatever way we can. So I'm producing a documentary on it called Sound of Redemption, and it will be out in April.
Well, why don't we open it up to questions now? How do we do it? Okay.
Thank you.
And can you stand up and make me a little easier?
Sure. You mentioned Muse, perhaps your Muse. I'm wondering if content ever streams through you so that several pages get written and then you read them as if for the first time.
I mean, as you describe it, no, I wouldn't say that happens. I know there's writers who say like characters do things that they never expected or shock them and stuff like that. To me, I really look at it as a craft, and you know, I'm the maestro or whatever you want to call it. So I know, you know, what is all happening. But at the same time, I don't outline or anything like that. And so every day I sit down to write, it either happens or it doesn't, or it happens well or it doesn't. And I'm a big editor, rewriter. You know, I start every day rewriting the day before. And in that process, you see what you did just the day before, and like, it's not like, who wrote this? It's more like, this is really good or this is really bad. And, you know, and so sometimes you're surprised by one or the other. You're surprised that you pulled that off, like, you know, an exchange of dialogue, and you really like it, or the opposite, you know. So it's weird. It's a weird, it's funny. I was in New York last night at a library, and I did something with Martin Cruz Smith, who's a writer I really admire, and he's suffering from Parkinson's, and he's had to start dictating writing without writing. He talks out loud while his wife writes down what he says, and our conversation was a lot about that, because I don't think I could write without my hands. I think there's something about, you know, obviously your hands don't have brains, but there's something about the process that is integral. So there's an automatic, I guess what I'm trying to say, it's like, I don't know if you ever know this jazz pianist named Keith Jarrett, who every time he performs, he just starts playing and it happens. And he says, like, my hands do the work. And in a way, I kind of feel that way with writing, that obviously my hands are attached to my head, but there is a very hard-to-explain mystical process involved.
Thank you for being here. I enjoyed your poker-playing cameo appearances on on television. Is there a camaraderie between you and the other poker-playing authors that show up on Castle every now and then?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think one of the things that is pretty fantastic about crime writers is that there's a camaraderie of everybody. There's no sense of, like, if they buy his book, they're not going to buy mine. It's like readers, especially people who like mysteries and crime fiction, they're voracious, and so there's plenty of fans and readers and so forth to go around. So I've never really encountered kind of animosity that I've actually heard about in other areas of literature and so forth. But to get to your question, yeah, I mean, I knew everyone I played with there, I knew before we were brought in. That whole thing kind of revolved around Stephen Cannell, who passed away a few years ago. And so they haven't done it. They did it one time to honor him, and then they haven't done it since, and I don't know if they'll ever get back to it. But everyone involved in that show, when they were in their early 20s and even some in the teens, got their start on Stephen Cannell shows, and like many of them were PA, production assistants who drove him around or got him lunch and stuff like that. And so now they have this successful show going, and they went back to him because now he was writing books and said, can you get some of your writing pals to gather around a table for these card games? And so it was pretty cool while it lasted. I don't know if we'll ever continue again.
Michael's best line on that show, or one of them, was they were playing cards, and there was this young writer who was a real obnoxious and really a big braggart, and he sold his first book, and he was really boasting about it. And then somebody said to Conley, what did you do after you sold your first book? He said, I kept my mouth shut and wrote 19 more.
I wish I could say we write our own lines, but that was...
It was a good line.
Whatever. That was scripted.
That was a good line. You might have said it.
Thank you for describing your process. I was wondering, do you experience writer's block? And if so, what do you do to overcome that?
I don't really experience it because of my background in journalism, where they don't allow that, in a newsroom. You got to write every day, and you just got to write every day. You got to find a way around it. So I think it's kind of given me a work ethic of maybe tricks or something to make sure it doesn't happen. I mean, you hit difficult spots where you've written yourself into a corner, or you're just not getting what the next move is. My cure for that is rewrite, it's like battering ram. You back up with the battering ram, and then you hit that locked door. So I back up a few pages and just rewrite those pages, and hopefully it takes me through whatever the block was. And I'm very lucky, that it has not really hit me in any way.
At the LA Times, we had a synonym for writer's block, and that was unemployment. Yeah. And you always wonder about people with the journalism background don't really suffer from it. So you don't hear a plumber saying, well, they have plumber's block today. I don't think I'm going to be able to come to work. People who make their living writing, I think they just, they write. They go to work, and maybe, like Michael said, it works or it doesn't. It goes well, it doesn't go well, but they still go to work.
Yeah.
Thank you. Two quick questions. You mentioned Harry's daughter. Do you see her as a major character in the future? And the second question is, I understand you don't live in L.A. anymore, so how do you keep your selection of L.A. sites fresh without being here all the time?
On Maddie, yeah, I think she would be. I mean, right now I would just say she's, in the computer terms, an Easter egg. She's there to, if I want to go in that direction, I think I've laid the groundwork. She's told her dad she wants to be a cop, and so in the future, if I'm still writing and I'm looking for someone to kind of carry Harry's mission forward, like who would be better to do that than his daughter? So that's out there for me to use. Will it actually happen? I don't know. We'll see. On the book I'm writing now, Harry's training a new detective, and she's really interesting to me, and she could be the one who carries on the mission. I don't really know yet. I don't plan too far ahead. I know I have this 2015 thing over my head where Harry has to retire, but other than that, I'm not really thinking about that. And people say, do you miss LA and stuff, and it's kind of like I'm never away from LA long enough to miss it. I stay here I'm here a lot. It's still the place that inspires me. I think writers are always looking for how to keep momentum and how to keep it working. And so about 10 years ago, I thought, let me try to write about this place from afar. I would come in, cast my net, do my research, do my interviews, take my pictures, and then I'd go 3,000 miles away to write about it. And I think it's worked pretty well. I'm feeling a change is coming soon that I gotta, I wrote one way for about 10 years, and I wrote this way for about 10 years. I think I want to write another way for 10 years. I'm not sure what that is, but I just think I'm feeling some kind of creative need to move on in some way, and I don't know what that will be yet.
What do you said you wrote one way for 10 years, then you wrote another way for 10 years. What can you explain?
Well, the first 10 years of writing, I lived here in L.A., and I was coming off of my years as a journalist, and so I was really still like a journalist. And so I would, if I was going to write about Angel's Flight, I'd go down and hang around Angel's Flight and write Angel's Flight, and then I'd go back and write that night. And now there's a separation of time and distance between me. You know, I spent a lot of time earlier this year in Mariachi Plaza and Boyle Heights, and it was probably between the time I was there looking at that place and taking some pictures, and I wrote about it in this book I'm working on, maybe 6-7 weeks, and so there's a less immediacy than when I first was writing these books, and I think that has something to do with the immediacy that journalism brings.
Since you wrote your first book, we've seen a lot of changes in technology, cell phones, GPS, the internet. How has that affected how you write, how you plot, how you create the stories?
Well, if you're going to reflect, you know, accurately on what's going on in society, you got to draw that stuff in. It actually makes, on a practical level, a little bit more difficult, you know, when information is so immediate. It's hard to, like in a plotting or something, like where Harry used to have to wait for some kind of piece of information, and I could do all these other things till we got that information. Now a lot of stuff comes a lot quicker. You know, with Harry, I've kind of grudgingly brought him into, you know, the modern ages and the use of things. But, you know, I think, you know, everything can work for you or work against you. Moving him into a cold case squad, I think, was very helpful because it's definitely an application of technology that starts his case. So it's kind of like this dinosaur who grudgingly accepts technology and then goes and does it his way. But, you know, it's hard to keep up with stuff. I remember I wrote a book a few years ago called Scarecrow about, you know, the continuing newspaper story of Jack McAvoy. And I left the newspaper business, in 1994 when everything was great and the LA Times was a velvet coffin. No one wanted to leave there. And the business is so different now. And I don't know, I was about to say stupidly, but without thinking, I just wrote a story about a reporter. And then I gave it to a couple people who were still active journalists. And they said, yeah, it's a great story, but you should set it in 1989 because it's not like this anymore. And so I had to rewrite that book with the bringing in the application of the technological changes and also the downward changes of the whole industry. Yep.
Yes, hi. I've been wondering since your first books, how did you manage to locate Harry Bosch and Woodrow Wilson?
It's actually kind of a long story. I was a reporter covering crime at the LA Times. I got called one morning by an editor and said, go up to this location on Woodrow Wilson Drive because there's a woman's been murdered and her body's sitting in the street. And there was a lot of murders, especially back then in the late 80s. So unfortunately, newspapers kind of put a value on murders. And you know, Los Angeles is so spread out most of the time. I would handle stuff by phone, so I knew something was up that they would actually want me to go to the crime scene. So I said, what is it? And they said, the body's in front of David Hockney's house, and he's a famous painter. So if he had any connection, it was going to be a big story. Ultimately, he had zero connection. But so I went up there, and I was in the middle of writing the first Harry Bosch book, and I knew I wanted to have a back deck. It was before I wrote that book, I knew this would be a component of this character, that he would have a perch where he would look out at the city and consider the city and his place in it and all those things. And so I was looking for that. And so I was at a police tape, you know, waiting for detectives to come tell us what happened. Other reporters were there. And there was one of these cantilever houses that had burned. Yeah, well, there's a bunch up there, but there was one that had burned down. And the fire department or someone, you know, had come and slid all the charred debris off. And so all that was there was cantilevers and a flat surface and then like a do not cross tape. And so I lifted the tape up and walked out on the deck. And I just instinctively said, this is where Harry Bosch will look at the city. And what's weird about it is that place has never been rebuilt. And the platform that I stood on was wood. It's rotted and fallen through. And all that's there right now, this is like 25 years ago, all that's there now are the cantilevers sticking up, rusted. So there's really no house where Harry Bosch lives.
Do you have to pay the lawyers that you talked to, that you referred to early in the piece, that you pass problems by?
You said, do I have to?
No, do you?
I do, yes.
Okay.
I don't have to, but I do. I mean, I've had, it's like the gods of guilt. I wouldn't want to take some of these great stories they tell me and go laughing all the way to the bank with it. The success of this series is based on real people's inspiration and stories and so forth. So, and any kind of consultants that I have, if there is success, they share in it. So, we're finished.
Well, thank you, Michael, for your
thank
talk,
you. And thanks for being here.
And,
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.